history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have done some pretty remarkable things for the sake of our country. And if we take the time to listen to their stories, we're educated, we're entertained, even inspired by these members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And today we're going to meet a 92-year-old World War II veteran, lives in Orem, Utah, just up the road from where you were born in Provo. Max de St. Jour is our guest today. And Provo, Utah, what was that like when you were a kid growing up with three brothers and three sisters?
A lot of work in the farm.
What did you guys grow?
Beets, sugar beets, alfalfa, just about everything, you know.
I've heard about some of those sugar beet harvests. In fact, there's even a high school in Salt Lake City. They're the beet diggers, because I guess they used to get out of school to harvest the beets.
That's right. They're called the beet diggers, Jordan High, I think.
That's right, and that sounds like hard work.
Yeah, it is. You plant them, then you thin them, and then you hoe them, and you finally harvest them after in the fall when it gets cold and muddy, and it's not a lot of fun.
And you were the third youngest of those seven kids, so I guess you had some older siblings to teach you some of that?
Yeah, I had three older brothers.
And all four of you boys would serve during World War II, and we're going to hear more about that. But I'm always curious to hear from folks who lived through the 1930s. Most of us today can't fathom what it was like during the Great Depression, and it certainly impacted some families more than others. But what do you remember about that time, and did you see the world around you changing a little bit?
Well, it changed, but we were lucky. We were able to harvest most of the food that we needed. You know, we had a lot of hard work, and you'd do anything for a dollar, you know. My dad would do all kinds of work, you know. He was really a hard worker.
Do you remember having some ambitions back then when you were a young boy growing up? Did you have some dreams or some things that you thought you were going to do with your life?
No, my biggest dream is, when do I get off this farm?
And I guess eventually Uncle Sam would take care of that for you, huh?
Yes, I worked in Provo. I worked, my first job was furniture, DTR Furniture it was called, Dixon Taylor Russell Furniture, repairing coal stoves. We used to put new grates and everything in them. That was really a black job. And then me and a buddy of mine went to aviation mechanic school in Salt Lake. And we went to California, and I went to work for Douglas Aircraft as an aircraft mechanic. And I'd done that for a couple of years before I was drafted into service.
Well, a lot of folks working in those aircraft factories had exemptions from the military because their work was vital to the war. Is that something that you could have had if you wanted to have it?
I think I probably could have got a deferment, but there were guys going out of there like crazy, you know, and so it was mostly women.
Yeah, a lot of those aircraft factories had a lot of women working in them. So what kind of planes were you working on there for Douglas?
Mostly I was working on the assembly line where we installed engines in A-20s. That's a medium bomber, two-engine bomber.
Yeah, the old A-20 Havoc. One question I like to ask every veteran who's on this show, because just about every single one has an answer and a pretty clear memory. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you found out that Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Yeah, I just got back. I went with some friends of mine up to Bozeman, Montana. And we got back that Sunday morning that's when I found out about it.
Did you hear it on the radio? Were people talking about it at church or running around town? Can you explain that to us?
I think I heard it on the radio. I don't remember for sure, but I'm sure it was on the radio where we heard about it.
And what did that mean at the time? I mean, did it strike you? Did it make an impression, or was it, okay, that's not that big a deal?
Well, I was kind of mad, and I had a buddy, a good friend of mine, that wanted to go to Salt Lake and hunt up some Japs and beat them up. I mean, everybody had that attitude, I think, to a certain extent.
Of the four boys there who served, you and your three brothers were all in the war. Who got into the service first?
My oldest brother. He went with the first draft out of Provo. And my two brothers went in the Navy. They enlisted at the same time. They went through a boot camp together, but they got separated after that. And I was the last one.
So we had one in the Army, two in the Navy, and you ended up in the Army Air Corps. Is that what you wanted?
I tried to get in the Navy, but strange as it may sound, in California, they said the quota was full. So I ended up in the Army Air Corps.
Which I guess fits, since you'd already been working at Douglas and working on these assembly lines. You knew a thing or two about aircraft. Yeah. But most guys I've interviewed who were in the Army Air Corps, they said they really wanted to be pilots. And some of them realized they wouldn't have a chance because of educational requirements and things like that. But was there a part of you that had that dream of being a pilot?
No, I never really had that. I figured I'd be too short-legged. But my real good friend, the one that I went to mechanic school with, he ended up as a B-17 pilot and got his 27 missions in. Then he went for United Airlines, and he worked for them for about 30 years until he had to retire.
Retirement? What's that? You don't know anything about that. You're still working at age 92.
Yeah, I've retired three times, but I keep coming back. It gives me something to do. It keeps me out of mischief.
I guess so. Well, keeping track of your five kids and those three dozen grandkids and great-grandkids and even a couple great-great-grandkids, I'm sure keeps you hopping, too. But none of them would have been here if you didn't make it through World War II. So tell me about when you did end up in the Army Air Corps. What were some of the things that they had you do as they prepared you to head overseas?
They were going to make a ball turret gunner on a B-17 out of me, I guess on account of my size. But when I got overseas, I ended up at this air depot, and they seen, I guess, by MOS, and they seen, well, this guy's got mechanical experience. So I lucked out. I think I've tell everybody that money I spent on that mechanic school was probably the best money I ever spent in my life, because it probably saved my life. Because when I first got over there, we were taking a kicking, you know, losing 200 planes go out on a mission and lose 60 on one day.
And of all the places in the plane to be, one of the most hazardous. Yeah. Was that ball turret for a lot of reasons, as I'm sure you saw firsthand. So yeah, maybe that mechanic school and them reading that on your form, that maybe saved your life, huh?
I'm sure it did. I'm thoroughly convinced it did.
Well, again, I'm sure all those kids and grandkids, all your descendants are pretty thankful for that. So you mentioned Base Air Depot, and we've had some folks on this show before who served at those, and you are at BAD 2. Doesn't mean you're getting into trouble, but that's the abbreviation for Base Air Depot. Tell us where that was and what that was like.
It was in Wharton, England. That's between Preston, England, and Blackpool, England. It was good duty. There was probably 10,000 guys there, and I even have a record here. All the planes we worked on, even the serial numbers of them.
And I'm sure we all want to know what kind of planes you worked on and what were your specific duties there and maybe even how taxing that was, you know, because some guys had some jobs in the service during World War II where it was real intense for a day or two and then they got a break, and other guys it was all day, every day. So maybe you can give us a taste for the specific kind of work you did there.
Well, I was mostly ended up doing just about the same thing I was doing when I worked for Douglas, was installing engines. But we worked on all kinds of B-24s, B-17s, P-51s, P-47s, just about every kind of plane there was. If you had to install an engine on them, you had pretty much instructions on what to do on each one of them, you know.
And these are planes that have already been in action and need new engines, or they're brand new that you're putting together there?
Both, yeah. I mean, we done all kinds of repair work. And also, if there's any modifications on new planes that came in, we would do whatever had to be done on them. And then they had what they called a ferry squadron that would ferry them to different bases wherever they had to go.
Well, let me stay here for now with working on these. Did you have a favorite of all those planes that you worked on? Was there a particular model that you either enjoyed working on the most or you thought that would be the most fun to get up in the air in?
Well, I'm a favorite of the P-51. I really loved it. In fact, I've got to ride in a P-51 twice in my life. I tell everybody that they won the air war in Europe.
That was a lot of guys' favorite plane, and it was crucial in winning that air war. And until the Germans broke out those jets, it was the fastest thing in the sky. And I bet when you were working on those, if you had to install those engines, you probably had to not only use your eyes but your ears, huh? When it comes to that engine, doesn't it have a real distinctive sound when it's going?
Oh yeah, I can tell the sound of a P-51 if I was just in bed. They just have a distinct sound.
And you said you've been in a P-51 twice in your life. Yeah. Were those both after the war? Did you get to get up in one during the war?
One was during the war. We got we had one P-51 that they when they were unloading it off the ship in Liverpool, they dropped it and banged it all up, and so they took it into the salvage yard and was going to use it for spare parts. And the guys talked the old colonel into letting them rebuild it on their own time, and they rebuilt it and put two seats in it, and I got to ride in it. It made all the whiskey runs. After that, it was just a plaything of the base. And then the next time I rode one was, he was a good friend of mine, lived in Heber, it's up northeast of here. He owned one, and I went up with him in that P-51.
Which was a bigger thrill, while the war was going on or while you're back here in the States?
I think it was the one who went with, his name was Russ McDonald, because he really put it through the spins and all that, you know. In fact, my kids, you could ask my daughter here, she could tell you, that's my dad up in that plane. He says, I'm going to do a slow roll. What do you think, Max? And I said, well, go for it. So he did. Are you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. He says, well, I'll do a couple more.
Did you hold everything down?
Yeah, he says, he's a screamer. He's not a barfer.
Yeah, I don't know if I would be able to say the same for myself in those circumstances. So you get over there to England in 1943, and as you mentioned, at this point in the war, air superiority really belonged to the enemy. I mean, the Luftwaffe was shooting down American planes, the anti-artillery was heavy. I imagine you saw some planes come into your base in some pretty bad shape.
Yeah, in fact, I was amazed at some of them. You wonder how they could keep flying, especially the B-17. They could take a lot of abuse.
Did you guys have to do any of the body work, too, or just the engine work?
I didn't get in on any body work, but it all depended on what department you were in, you know, what your job was. I never got any sheet metal work or anything like that. It was mostly all engine work.
And when you're working on these planes and you see what the planes have been through, and then you think about the guys who were in the plane when it was going through that, I imagine you have some pretty good perspective about the men, teenagers, guys in their young 20s, who were flying those planes. How do you feel about the guys who flew all those missions?
They had a lot of guts, I'll tell you. I don't know what the life expectancy was on them, but they were losing a lot of them. In fact, I had a good friend that got shot down, and I told him, I always had a fear of having to bail out, you know. And he says, well, I'll tell you something. If those flames start licking in your rear end, you'll jump.
Not something you want to have to find out firsthand, but so many of them did during World War II. So many questions come to mind, and with regard to the work you're doing on these engines, and maybe it seems a little mundane to you because that's what you've always done, but I imagine there were some cases that were a bigger challenge than others, and some that instruction manual isn't going to give you all the answers, and you had to improvise a little bit. Can you think of any stories like that where you came up with a creative fix that you felt good about?
No, I don't remember anything like that. You had plenty of supervisors, you know, that had more knowledge than you did, but it could help you if you run into a problem.
Did you get a kick out of some of the nose art that those planes had?
Oh, yeah, I got quite a few of them in this book here I'm going to show you. Can you just see them doing that nowadays?
I don't think it would last very. It would be a little different caliber, I suppose. Although if you watch television, it's probably worse than all the nose art. What about life in that spot with all these other Americans who are over here in England? How did you guys get along with each other, and how did you interact with the Brits around there?
I loved the British people. They were, I think they realized that we were saving them, you know. I really liked the British people. In fact, I even had some of them coming and stay here at my house after, and I got along good with all the guys I worked with, you know. They were just a good bunch of guys.
What'd you do on your downtime? Did you get yourself into any trouble?
No, I didn't get any trouble, but we used to go to Blackpool and, you know, the dances and stuff like that, but I never did get any trouble. I could have. I'm sure there was times when I could have, but I lucked out.
Where you were, and, you know, you're not flying the missions. You're not on the front lines in the infantry like your brother was. You're not on a ship like your other brothers were. But did you ever feel like the spot you were in was a dangerous place to be and that you guys could be targeted there?
Oh, yeah. I can't figure out how we did get bombed because our air base was just wall-to-wall planes. But we did have a real disaster.
Well, hold that thought because I don't want to cut that story short, but it's break time for now. When we come back, 92-year-old Max de St. Jour will tell us about the day tragedy hit Base Air Depot 2 in England. And remember, he had three brothers serving in the war. We're going to find out how Max learned one of those brothers would not be coming home to Utah. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find some photos of today's guest, 92-year-old Max de St. Jour of Orem, Utah. You'll also find photos and information relating to the Freckleton Air disaster and the tragedy that unfolded on August 23, 1944. There was a violent storm blowing in on Base Air Depot 2 in Wharton, England. Winds reported as strong as 60 miles an hour, water spouts in a nearby estuary, flash flooding all around. If you were to go to Wharton today, you would find a memorial to the 61 people who perished that day, 3 aboard a malfunctioning B-24, 58 more on the ground. It's a reminder that everywhere is dangerous during wartime. This came at a time that the Allies were advancing across Europe after the landing at Normandy. England would seem like a safer place, but not on August 23, 1944, in Wharton. Max, what do you remember about that day?
It was about lunchtime, and it got just almost dark, black clouds and that, and we had a B-24 come in to crash. It went right through a cafe. Sad Sack Cafe, they call it. It went through the and landed in the town square right next to a elementary school. It killed, I think, 36 of those little kids. Oh, no. They just had a mass funeral and burial for all those kids. And they had GIs carrying the caskets on their shoulder, two GIs to a casket. And this one good friend of mine, by the name of Tom Miller, he was carrying this little girl. And after the war, when he come home, got married, and he had a daughter, and he named her after this little girl that he had carried. And when we went back there for a reunion in 1995, his daughter got to go back with him, and she got to meet the mother of the little girl. That it was kind of a tear-jerking situation, you know, really a sad situation. But
yeah, I can only imagine. And then I imagine, too, just trying to put myself in your shoes. Here you're over there. You're a 20-year-old kid from Provo, Utah. You're half a world away from your family. Your brothers are off in this war, too. And everything you read, everything you hear on the radio, and then this that you see right in front of your eyes at your base, it's just tragedy all the time. How did you process that? How did you make sense of that?
Well, it was just something you got, I guess you just say you got used to, you know. But that was quite a experience, you know, have all that happen there at the base.
While you were over there also, did you get a sense of how devastating the damage that England had endured was, with bombings and buzz bombs and all of that?
Oh, yeah. You go to London, it's just blow your mind how much damage there was and destruction, you know. It was terrible. Those English people, I always admired them because they really stuck together. And
from all the veterans I've talked to, you all tell me that America stuck together during this time, too, that everybody was on the same page. And for you personally, did you have a clear understanding of why you were doing what you were doing and what the whole purpose of it was?
Oh, yeah. I think it was just something that you knew had to be done. You know, you didn't like it maybe, but you knew that it had to be done.
And you mentioned how rough it was when you first got over there, how many planes were being shot down and how big the losses were. As time went on, could you sense a shift, even being there on the ground in England? But because of the work you were doing with all these planes, did you notice a difference? And could you tell that the tide was turning?
Oh, yes, you could tell because you had more planes coming back. You wouldn't have near the casualties you were when they first started. It was a tide that just got a little better all the time, you know, until the end.
And I want to hear about what you remember about the end, but I'm also curious, since you were one of four brothers all serving in this war at the same time, I don't know what your mother did with all her time other than pray nonstop if she's got four sons out there in this war. What, if anything, did you hear from your brothers? Were you in touch with them?
Oh, yeah. We had letters back and forth all the time. Not a lot, but you kept in touch pretty good, you know.
Did you ever think, man, I'm glad I'm not where that brother is?
Oh, yeah, I was glad I wasn't in Italy where my brother was.
And you're talking about your oldest brother. What was his name?
His name was Francis. He was in the 3rd Infantry.
One of the big battles in Italy, the big beachhead at Anzio, he was involved in that. Did you know that he was going to be part of that battle?
No, I didn't know until, you know, I didn't know where he was at for sure. Nobody told you, you know, you couldn't find out. All you had was an APO number, you know. I didn't know I didn't even realize he was where he was at until I got the word that he'd been killed.
Well, and I think our listeners would be interested in that story of how you found out. So you had been trading letters with him, and you could actually get a letter to him faster in Italy than you could to your folks back here in Utah. How was it that you found out that he had been killed?
Well, I got two letters back from him that I had sent with just deceased written on them. So I didn't know. I was hoping some mail clerk had goofed up or something, you know. But I didn't know. It was just two letters that I had sent to him that come back to me with just deceased written on them. And I didn't dare write home and say anything until I knew for sure, you know. It was kind of a tough 2 weeks.
I can't imagine what that feels like here. I mean, you're over there, and you know that even if you feel like you're in a safe place, that danger is always lurking, and then to find out your brother has been killed. Did it take you a while to get over that? How did you cope with that news?
Oh, I don't know. It just, it was sad for a while, you know, and I felt more sorry for my poor little mother, and that bothered me more than, you know, anything.
And I've talked to quite a few veterans who lost siblings in the war, and their perspective's always a little different than those who didn't. And so many of you always tell me, hey, quit calling me a hero. The heroes are the guys who didn't come home. Your brother didn't come home. But some people have said, I really didn't want to know too much about what happened, and others really wanted to find out as much information as they could. Did you ever gather more information about what happened to him and how he was killed?
Yeah, I had a good friend that was in the same outfit that went and got to visit with him a couple of days before he got killed. And he told me that the artillery was coming over like crazy, you know. He says that was no place to be. But that's the only thing I've heard about it was what his name was Kent Snyder. He told me about it, you know.
You said about Pearl Harbor Day that it made you angry, and you talked about the way other people reacted to it. When you're in the European theater and you find out that the same enemy you're working against has killed your brother, did that make you angry? Did that add something to your resolve or determination?
Oh, yeah, it made me angry, you know. It's just, let's get this over with. Let's kick some rear. Let's get it over with.
And your role in that was not a small one. I mean, maybe this is something that you were suited for and you'd been doing your whole life, working on engines and all this, but I mean, did you ever grasp, I mean, how big a role you played and how what kind of impact you had? I mean, every engine that you're working on really is a 10-man crew's life in your hands if it's a B-17. Did you feel that responsibility or that importance?
Oh, no, you wanted to make sure they was right, you know. You worried about, you know, I hope this is everything is okay, you know. Hope it all works out.
Since you were over there from 43 through the end of the war in Europe, so you're there in England when the Normandy invasion takes place. You're there when the Battle of the Bulge happens and really every major development of that war. Is that something that you guys would react to there in England? I mean, when you got news of those kinds of things, was that a big deal? Do you remember how that news came in or what it meant to y'all?
Yeah, I can remember Battle of the Bulge. The guys at our base, the ones that they didn't figure were essential, they were instant infantry. We lost quite a few guys out of the base that they was from the Air Corps to the infantry immediately.
Because so many guys were killed and wounded, they needed those bodies, and yeah. That could have happened to you.
It sure could have. I lucked out all the way around. I'll be the first to admit it.
Well, do you think it was luck, or was somebody looking out for you? Was somebody pulling some strings for you?
Well, I don't think anybody was pulling any strings, but maybe it was just luck.
VE Day. What do you remember about that? How was that received at your base there in England?
Oh, gosh, everybody shooting guns in the air and hollering and raising cane. Just a lot of celebration.
But you still didn't get yourself in any trouble?
No, I didn't get in any trouble.
Once that happened, were you thinking, hey, I might get to go back home to Utah?
We didn't know, but I have to tell you a little story. We didn't know whether we were going to have to go to the Pacific or what, but it ended up we come back to the States, and my outfit disbanded in Tampa, Florida. I went down there, and we were unpacking all the equipment, and we had this one big box that was stamped office equipment, and we opened it up. It was a moonshine still. The guys, they didn't know whether they were going to go to the Pacific or what, so they wanted to make sure they had something where they could make whiskey, you know. That captain, he went berserk. What in the hell are we going to do with this?
I'm sure some guys had some ideas.
Yeah. Well, that was the whole idea. If they thought it was going to go to the Pacific, they were going to be ready.
I imagine that was quite a relief to find out you didn't have to go to the Pacific.
Yeah, it was. I was glad to get home.
And what was that like to see your mother again? Because you know that she's lost one of her boys, and now you're coming home and to see your folks and your family. What was that like?
Well, it was great. In fact, when I got out of the service, I rode a bus from Tampa, Florida to Los Angeles because my one brother was getting out of the Navy in Shoemaker, California, and I waited there 3 or 4 days for him to get out. He never showed up. So my brother-in-law drove truck for an outfit here in Orem, and they were coming to Provo. So I bummed a ride home with them, and I left that morning, and my brother got in that afternoon. So it was a while after that before I got to see him. My other brother, he was living in Orem. He got home. He beat me home.
Was it difficult to get on with life after you got out of the service, or was that an easy transition for you?
It was a pretty easy transition for me. I ended up doing a lot of the same things, you know, but it wasn't much of a transition for me. I done fine with it.
How often, I mean, it's been 70 years since all this happened. How often in those early years after the war and maybe even on till today, have you found yourself thinking about your brother Francis?
Oh, yeah, I think about it all the time, you know. He and I probably didn't get along as good as we should have, you know, but he was more of a, he's the oldest brother, so he was more domineering, you know, and I kind of resented that, so we had our difference at times, but always felt bad about that. I think we hadn't had a better relationship than we did, you know. But
have you ever found yourself wondering what his life would have looked like? I mean, you know your life, you're still going strong here at 92 with all these kids and grandkids and even great-great-grandkids. Have you ever wondered what his life would have looked like?
Oh, yeah, you think about that. You know, he was married. He got married just before he went into service. You wonder how would he have made out, you know, what he'd have done. When he went into service, he was working for Utah Power and Light. He had a good job, but he went on the first draft.
Well, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth or put thoughts in your head, but something tells me when you went to the National World War II Memorial, which you had to wait a long time for that puppy to be built, but you've been back there a couple times, even for a reunion with your base air depot. When you got to that memorial and you saw that wall of gold stars and realized that's 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, I'm guessing you might have thought about your brother a little bit there.
Yeah, I thought about him. In fact, I contributed $100 to have his name. I didn't know whether you're going to put him on the memorial or what, but they have a record of all those.
Yeah.
So I made sure that he got his name on that.
Yeah, if you go to the World War II Memorial, you can go to a kiosk and search the registry and find those names. And some veterans have shared that, you know, they go to the Vietnam Memorial and they see all the names on the wall, and sometimes they're disappointed that they don't see the names at the World War II Memorial of those who were killed. Does that bother you at all, or is it just too big of a task, you think?
Well, I was a little disappointed. I thought maybe they'd have the names on the memorial somewhere, but there's probably so many they probably couldn't have got them all on there.
406,000 names would take up a lot of space, but I still think it would be powerful to have them all listed somewhere in a permanent memorial. Not to take away from the gem of the National Mall, that gorgeous memorial we've been talking about, but just a new way to recognize all of those, like Francis de Saint-Jour, who paid the ultimate price. It's time to take another break, but remember, you can find photos relating to today's program at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I also have some links where you can dig deeper into the Freckleton air disaster that Max witnessed. When we come back, we're going to learn about a special way that Max and his family have honored the legacy of his brother and other veterans in their hometown. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting RVCountry.com. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. for what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Visiting today with 92-year-old Max de St. Jour of Orem, Utah. Perhaps the nation's oldest delivery driver. If you know of an older one, let me know. I'm looking forward to the next few episodes that I have to share with you. Over the last few weeks, I've spent some time with some remarkable veterans in Oregon, California, Utah, and Arizona. And you're going to hear their stories in the weeks ahead, including the amazing story of the Candy Bomber, or Uncle Wackelflügel, as they know him in Germany because of the Berlin airlift. Remember, if there's a veteran in your life that you'd like me to catch up with, you can submit the name and some information at hometownheroesradio.com. When we left off with Max de St. Jour, we discussed his experience in a couple of journeys to the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. And don't forget, the Honor Flight Network continues to take veterans all over the country to Washington to see that memorial absolutely free of charge. And Max, you shared how the memory of your late brother Francis, who was killed while fighting in Anzio, Italy in April of 1944, how that was on your mind as you visited the National World War II Memorial.
I guess the other thing I'm curious about is, in light of your brother's death, did that affect at all the way you lived and whether or not you took things for granted or the responsibility you felt for your life?
Well, I think for years and years, I made the crosses and set them up at the Orem Cemetery, veterans crosses, at least 30 years. And I've been in the Veterans Foreign Wars for 60 years, and I kind of felt like that was one way to honor him.
Honor him and honoring a lot of other guys in the process. That trip to Washington, D.C., to see that World War II memorial and see all your buddies that you served with in England, what did you get out of that? What struck you about that memorial? And did it capture what it's supposed to capture?
Oh, I think so. It's a beautiful memorial. You know, I don't know how to describe it. It was quite impressive to me.
Is there one part of it? Because it's a pretty big place, and there are a lot of different things you can look at. The different storyboards depicting different battles. Of course, every state is listed there with its own pillar, the fountain, the wall of gold stars. Is there part of it that kind of held the most meaning for you or got to you the most?
Well, I just more or less wanted to look where the state of Utah was on there, you know.
Well, and I know I'm bouncing around here. You mentioned that your brother had been married before he went over. Did you have a special someone you were hoping to come back to when you were overseas?
No, I didn't have anybody in particular.
So you never would have met her if you didn't get back from over there.
That's right.
And I mentioned it earlier, you're still working at age 92. I don't know if there's a record for the elder statesman among all the delivery drivers in the country, but tell me what you're doing these days and why you're still working at 92.
Well, I feel like I should stay active as much as I can, you know. And it just, I deliver parts, and there's guys that I deliver parts to that used to work for me when I worked for Ford. You know, it's just, I like to go shoot the bull with them, you know, and it just gives me something to do, and I don't know how much longer I'll do it, but the kids all want me to quit now, you know, but I'll just have to see how things go.
Well, and that even got you a trip to Washington, D.C., huh? That you got a trip there because you were, tell me what that award was?
The oldest worker in Utah. Outstanding worker, I think they called it. Outstanding older worker. And that was an all expense paid trip back there. Really nice.
Something tells me you probably got a few handshakes and congratulations from some bigwigs back there.
Yeah. It was they had a person from each state. There was some of them pretty old.
You weren't the oldest one there, huh?
No, not then. I probably would be now.
Well, I talk about bigwigs. I guess that's the other thing that comes to mind. You were over there in England for quite a long time. Did you ever have some famous folks or some notable names that came through where you were?
Oh, yeah. When I was taking basic training, you know, I took basic training at Atlantic City, and I was on guard duty this one day, and that's where Glenn Miller was forming the band. And then we had Bob Hope and Bing Crosby, Joe Louis, Billy Conn, all of them come to our base there at one time or another, you know.
Not Joe Louis and Billy Conn at the same time where you could get them in a ring together, huh?
They were traveling together, but they weren't in the ring.
And you didn't volunteer to get in the ring with them?
No.
You know, and I've talked to some folks who have some real strong memories about some of those USO shows and all that. And, you know, some people say, what does that have to do with fighting a war? What did it mean to you guys that, you know, these big stars who you saw in the movies and you heard on the radio would come out there and perform for you?
It was great. I mean, it was something that I had a lot of admiration for them, you know. I admired them. I think Bob Hope, he was all over the world. In fact, was it Glenn Miller? He came up missing, you know. He was at our base a couple of days before that. In fact, his band was still there at our base when
his plane went down?
Yeah, they never did find him or anything, so.
That must have been a pretty heavy feeling there at your base, huh?
Yeah, everybody felt bad about that.
Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. Thank you for setting the bar for those of us who want to finish strong, because it looks like you're nowhere near the finish line. You've got so much momentum going here. When it comes to World War II, since most of us, including all your descendants, which is a pretty big number, none of us were alive while World War II was going on. We didn't live through it and feel it and experience it the way you did. What do you think that people today need to know about that time in our nation's history and why it still matters?
Well, I think they should teach a little more of it in school. I mean, there's so many of these kids that don't have a clue. They don't have an idea what went on. You know, I think that they should know. But I think that's one thing where they're lax is they're not teaching enough history about World War II.
What gives you the most pride, personally, as a World War II veteran?
Oh, just being able to serve, I guess. I don't have any, I was no hero or anything like that. I was just proud to serve.
Well, and we're proud of you and proud to know you. At hometownheroesradio.com, you can find a link to a news story about Max when he was given that Prime Time Award from an organization called Experience Works. He was taken to the White House and the National World War II Memorial. The headline calls him an Iron Man, and that was 7 years ago. He's still going. What an example he set for his family. That family includes children, grandchildren, great-grandkids, and even great-great-grandkids now. And since his son Dave is here, maybe he can add a little more perspective.
So Dave, your dad mentioned putting crosses at the Orem Cemetery as a tribute to his brother and other servicemen, but it didn't sound like that big a deal when he mentioned it. He was very humble about it, but this was a pretty big undertaking, and he got the whole family involved?
Yeah, for approximately 30 years, our Memorial Day weekend was spent honoring the veterans at the Orem Cemetery, and my dad would build the crosses, built the nameplates, the whole part of the crosses, and we would spend the weekend putting them up at the cemetery in rows and to honor the veterans, and I'm really proud of the work that he did, you know, for those 30 years that we all did to honor our veterans. And that was just one way he showed, you know, honoring the other veterans and his brother and his colleagues. So
I imagine that made a pretty strong impression on you and probably shaped your perspective on those who have fought and died for us.
Oh, we're really a patriotic family and honor our veterans and love them all. And yeah, we're really proud of his service and all his brothers it's a family thing.
And that tradition he started with the crosses didn't stop when he stopped doing it. That's something that lives on, right?
Yeah, the American Legion in the town now takes care of it. They have a trailer for them all, and they have help from some of the local organizations to put them all up that we used to do as a family. Now there's an army of 40 or 50 helpers that do it now, but yeah, we were honored to do it.
I know he's sitting right here, but I get the sense that you're pretty proud of this guy, that you have a lot of respect for him. What does he mean to you? And when you understand what he and all his brothers did in World War II, how does that make you feel about him?
I just think that our freedom and stuff, it just needs to be recognized what all these guys did back then, and all the veterans, you know, we're just honored that he got to serve, and we're honored that his brothers got to serve and what they accomplished and what all of the veterans have accomplished in all the wars. So, and my big brother, yeah, my oldest brother is an Army veteran also. He was in for over 30 years. He was drafted, but spent 30 years in the service, and he's also a veteran. And so we're a patriotic family, I think.
Have you guys started planning the party you're going to have when he renews his driver's license at age 100?
Yeah, we're a little worried about that, but I think he's still a pretty good driver even at 92, so we don't worry about him too much, just on snowy roads.
Well, driving over here on State Street today, they wouldn't let me go more than 20 miles an hour anyway, so maybe it's safe out there. Max, I didn't ask you, what's your secret? You're 92, you're still driving, you're still working, everybody can hear how sharp you are.
I've got a goal. My goal is to be shot at by a jealous husband at my 100th birthday.
You don't have a specific jealous husband in mind, do you?
No, not yet.
I hope you know how to duck.
Yeah, you heard me say, I said shot at.
Not shot.
Right.
Well, for the rest of you husbands out there, at least we've all been forewarned. And if you really want to be on the lookout, check out the photos of Max at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You never know what you're going to hear on this show, but so often it's something you've never heard before. Thanks for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time, and reminding you once more that freedom is not free. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's RV country within driving distance of this radio station. But really, it doesn't matter where you live, because Paul Everett has a fly and buy program that will fly you to any of his locations to buy your new RV.
It's one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Serving RVers for 55 years, you'll find Paul Everett's RV country throughout the West and online at rvcountry.com.